listening to the Anarchist Book Club with Jim Yeoman and me, Danny Evans. In this edition, we're talking about Julius S. Scott's book, The Common Wind, Afro-American Currents in the Age of the Haitian Revolution, which was originally a PhD thesis presented in 1986 at Duke University, and which was put out finally as a book by Verso in 2018. We really enjoyed chatting about this book. If you have any comments or feedback about the programme, we're on the Twitters at ABC Danny and Jim, and we're also on the emails abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com. Hope you enjoy it. Okay, so Jim, why did you want to read this book?
I guess it's kind of going back to where we started with the podcast, but it was kind of, I saw it and I thought, that looks really interesting. I know bits and pieces about the Haitian Revolution, but not a huge amount. It's been a long time since I read Black Jacobins by C.L.R. James. It seemed to tick quite a lot of boxes and things I found interesting in that kind of idea of transnational radicalism, movement, thinking about how revolutions develop across borders, and tying in again with some of the themes that we've discussed in the podcast. So thinking about slavery, about emancipation, black self-emancipation, like we discussed with David Roediger's book last week. And yeah, tying in with ideas of, you know, exchange, you know, what we talked about with Constance Bantman. It seemed to come highly recommended as well. You know, a few people I know have told me about this book, and yeah, it gets a good reviews kind of all around as well. So that, yeah, they were the main draws for me.
Just, I suppose, for listeners who maybe aren't familiar with the book tries to sort of sketch out the worlds of communication among slaves and masterless people in the revolutionary Atlantic in the age of the Haitian Revolution, so end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century. And it focuses mostly, I suppose, on the Caribbean islands and also into, you know, Venezuelan coast and things. It's really extraordinary when you think that this book is a PhD thesis, basically. So Verso published it a couple of years ago. It's the first time it's come out as a book. It was originally a PhD thesis that the author, Julius Scott, completed in the mid to late 80s, so ages ago. It's enjoyed this, like, afterlife as a manuscript that's photocopied, passed around and things by researchers into slavery and into, like, Atlantic history. When you think about, like, what the book accomplishes and the breadth of its approach, it really is amazing. If you want to do a PhD these days, the first thing that somebody, like your supervisor, would want to know is, like, whether this project is feasible. Like, is it, like, something that you're going to be able to do in 3 or 4 years or whatever? You know, have you identified the archives necessary? You know, good understanding of the field. And this fellow, Julius Scott, right, he must have had that kind of conversation. I know, like, you know, the whole world of academia has changed a lot in the last 30 years or whatever. But still, he must have, like, had this conversation where he said to somebody, well, I'm going to look at the world of vagabonds and peddlers and higglers, runaway slaves and army deserters, you know, people whose documentary traces are hard to find. And I'm going to do that in colonial Caribbean, also looking at the United States, South America. And so, like, the archival reach of that, you know, is going to take him to European archives, Caribbean archives, and North American archives. And in that process, he's going to basically be kind of inventing the field of Atlantic history. So somebody said to him, yeah, okay, you know, that sounds like a reasonable project. It just seems like the kind of conversation that is just unthinkable. It's amazing that was thinkable, that he did think that and that he went ahead and did it. Kind of remarkable that he didn't produce a book. Like, you know, this Julius Scott is not like, he's obviously very highly thought of, and a lot of people studied with him and things who have gone on to, like, have, you know, stellar academic careers and all this kind of malarkey. But he just seems to have, like, got on with his career as a lecturer. I think, like, he only retired quite recently, but not, like, as a professor or, like, you know, this big star of the university with loads of time off and, you know, loads of grant money and, you know, really well known and everything. It seems to have, like, had a fairly sort of modest kind of career. And this book is only just being put out. And it's kind of amazing, really, when you think, like, this is, like, the best part of 10 years before the Black Atlantic, even, you know, which we've looked at. And the Black Atlantic is obviously, you know, is considered to be like this, but it is a pioneering work. But even though Julius Scott doesn't use that term, the Black Atlantic, that's really what he's writing about all this time before. And he's not just, you know, like, not to denigrate Gilroy's achievement, you know, because as became clear, I'm like a massive fanboy of Gilroy's. You know, like, Gilroy is like looking at like published works by quite major figures, whereas Scott is like, you know, he's rooting around in the archives for traces of people who were otherwise completely forgotten. You know, he resuscitates them and restores them to their place in revolutionary history in a way that, you know, is really bears comparison to like people like E.P. Thompson, but does it in a way that's perhaps in some ways even more remarkable than E.P. Thompson, because, you know, it's scattered across these different national borders and boundaries, you know, involves like different languages. I just think there's a saying, I think, you know, paying homage to what, you know, what is like a remarkable achievement, and, you know, the kind of brass neck that it must have required for somebody who's not, you know, he's not like, you know, at the top of his career, and he's just starting out, and he like writes this, a book of this ambitious, this like with this kind of breadth and scope. And, you know, as a hopefully the conversation will bear out, you know, has a lot to reflect on in terms of revolutionary history and just how we think about revolutions and change.
It's quite apt. The manuscript was written in the 80s and was passed around within certain circles, within this kind of growing field of study on the Black Atlantic and kind of radical transnationalism, you know, rather like the sources that he's looking at, these kind of clandestine handbills and pamphlets and snippets of oral traditions and so on. Like this work itself has a similar sort of existence. And I agree about the kind of startling fact that this is basically a PhD thesis, because not only could have, because of its breadth and its ambition, as you've really nicely outlined, but also enviable breeziness of prose, of you know, it's very readable, it's very accessible. I don't know an awful lot about the Haitian Revolution or really anything about the pre sort of French Revolution Caribbean, which is kind of where the majority of the book is situated. And yet, you know, I was taken into that world of sailors and, as you say, peddlers and vagabonds and runaways, you know, very, very smoothly and very easily and convincingly. This work could be published right now and it would feel of this time, you know, and to think that it was, you know, done in the 80s. But one thing it doesn't do, which a lot of kind of contemporary transnational stuff does, including my own to some extent, you know, it doesn't over theorize it. It takes it as a kind of, lays out this thesis of the masterless people, which is borrowed from Christopher Hill, the historian of radicals during 17th century. But that's about as far as it gets. And it doesn't kind of labor on too kind of conceptual to say it. Rather, it gives you the nuts and bolts of it and the feeling of movement and of change in that way, kind of going from people to people. The only kind of big theorizing I pulled out of it, which I felt particularly came up early on in the work, was this idea of reciprocity between the changing world of imperialism and capitalism, and how that then changed this world of the masterless people, not, you know, intentionally. And that's, you know, that has echoes of a Marxist interpretation, you know, the kind of capitalism as generating its own grave diggers. Because what the upsurge in the plantation economies of the Atlantic, of the Caribbean and the United States generating is it's turning this kind of world of pirates and buccaneers, which is where Julius Scott starts the story, sort of end of the 17th century, turning that world into a more pointed, politically radical milieu in itself. You know, this increased movement of money brings, you know, you often see these kind of flourishes in the book, the movement of money, the movement of capital, the movement of slaves brings with it the mobility of people, of ideas, of sailors and so on. It's kind of these ironies kind of run through it, which I quite enjoyed.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, particularly like the struggle to control movement as a counter-revolutionary agenda, right, which obviously has huge resonances for our own time. But really, it's just a constant, isn't it? It's a constant of the capitalist social condition. But as you say, you know, at the same time, capitalism does imply commerce, trade, increasing contact in that sense. They can't stop sailors, seamen coming into contact with slaves or with, like, you know, workers on quaysides and things like that. You know, they just can't. They can't stop the fact that people are communicating with each other, bringing news, exchanging ideas. All of that is just so interesting. And like you say, it doesn't. The book doesn't try to make you understand some kind of framework or like theory. It just plunges you into a world of movement. Obviously, it indicates my own ignorance. Straight away, that's bracing and different from what I suppose we're trained to understand as slave society being like static, being controlled and what have you. And straight away, this is just like blown out of your mind, like within pages of this book, because it just plunges you into a sense of whirling, higgledy-piggledy movement of like ideas, debate. It's like a noisy book, isn't it? You can like hear the kind of the back and forth and the chatter and the like elaboration of the strategies of communication and things, even as you're reading. And, you know, considering we're talking in to each other in Liverpool, you know, which is where we live, where we act, that's something that we need to think about as well, right? Because Liverpool has this absolutely fundamental role within the slave trade. And of course, it's, you know, it's infamous. It's an infamous role. There's glimmers of like a radical heritage, even in the port city of Liverpool, even in this period, right? At the height of like Liverpool's like growth and wealth on the backs of slaves and of dehumanization and suffering. The Seamen's Revolt in Liverpool in 1775, where people marching in behind a red flag are pulling down the rigging of slave ships and, you know, are identifying themselves with the slaves, which is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, perhaps it's a very like modern mentality, I suppose, but like that to me came as a surprise because you just don't, I anticipated, right, as from a position of ignorance, that seamen working on slave ships would have been treated in such a way to like reinforce divisions between the free people on the ship and the slaves. And I'm sure, you know, in lots of ways that must have been the case. Like when you think about like the brutal way in which slaves were treated on boats, but at the same time, you know, Scott makes this really compelling case for slavers and seamen having this common enemy in the ship's captains, and of being able to make common cause in these situations. Like something like half of the people who go off on a slave ship working, seamen, don't come back on the return journey, because like partly because like loads of them die because it's so dangerous, but also because loads of them are kicked off the boat by the captain. They're not allowed to come back on, and loads of them desert and run away and like even forgo their wages to avoid going back on the ship. So all of that kind of stuff, I suppose, that you know, just like as I say, is like it comes from ignorance and prejudice on my part about, you know, a static society in which people like are aware of their place and are like sort of forced into an understanding of their position in this hierarchy, just is basically blown away because all of these people are relating to each other on a level that just basically has no regard for, you know, these categories with which we try and understand it and which have largely been invented subsequently, you know, as a counter-revolutionary agenda to basically to prise apart that world of communication and to keep people separate. This comes across really as an exciting idea in this book, you know, these masterless people, all these people who have a master but who are determined to become masterless through their own actions, have this common understanding of each other as human beings, of themselves as human beings, have a like an appreciation of what freedom would be, like what it is to live without a master. It doesn't just seem like modern. It seems almost like a message from the future as well as from the past.
That idea that it doesn't just seem modern, it seems almost, you know, kind of beyond, you know, what we're sort of capable of in some ways. And one thing that I think, you know, Scott does really well is he never frames this constant intermingling, this constant networks and webs of communication across, you know, all different various lines of class and race and national or imperial interests. It's never framed as something startling or odd or, you know, surprising. You know, often I get kind of frustrated with works, you know, particularly ones that are earlier in time, in kind of chronological time, that kind of almost have a tone of, yeah, like shock and surprise that people talk to one another in the past and found ways to communicate. I think that it should be a given, really, that we assume that people and oppressed people, you know, constantly try and find common cause with one another. Maybe they don't leave the best records for us to find, but that doesn't mean that it's not there. And again, it ties in again with my own frustrations about the way that, you know, people talk about contemporary movements, you know, using like the internet to communicate with one another as if this is something, you know, totally unprecedented. And I think, you know, works like this, you know, help us to see that people use whatever they have. And if that is, you know, handbills passed from a ship's deck to a shoreline, or if that's them themselves, as you say, you know, perhaps working on a slave ship and then ending up in Jamaica and then getting on a canoe and going to the southeast shore of Cuba. It is kind of, inspiring. It's inspiring as a historian and then also as someone that likes to think about how radical change and revolutions happen. Tying into that idea, I think another thing that Scott does very well is brings you into the geography, you know, the physical geography of the Caribbean at this moment, and particularly that sort of triangle between Saint Domingue, as it is at that point before it's Haiti, that when it's the French colony, as I say, the southeast of Cuba and then the northern shore of Jamaica, all of which are the less sort of constricted areas of those particular islands. Like the British presence is mainly on the south of Jamaica. Havana in Cuba is on the western side, kind of orientated to the United States. And yeah, you know, you get these images of almost kind of swampy deltas and unpopulated coastlines and coves. These places are closer together than perhaps we might sort of imagine. You know, these are a probably quite a difficult canoe ride, but they're a canoe ride away from one another, all of these different imperial worlds. I think that, again, it's something that's done almost sort of seamlessly through the book. Again, it doesn't hit you over the head with it, with a kind of big survey of the area. It's just kind of seen as a natural occurrence of how these islands sort of relate. And then that web sort of extends southwards down to the Dutch island of Curacao, and then on to Venezuela, and then to the coast of the United States, stretching back out to Liverpool, I think is, you know, as you say, is a really, for us, really poignant sort of moment when there's these rebellions about the treatment of whites on slave ships, basically. And then we find them not only protesting in the streets of Liverpool, but then kind of ending up on shore in Jamaica, chatting with runaway slaves and thinking of ways that they can either live their lives or change the society that they're in.
Let's come back on there, but just like, just the thing about Liverpool, it just offers an opportunity, isn't it, to think about like local history, not as whitewashing or as consolation, but to like sort of move beyond like either guilt or defensiveness, that you don't need to be an enlightened middle-class person writing letters to William Wilberforce, right, in order to have been participating in this struggle for abolition. It extends into different areas, and that's something that even in a book that focuses on the Caribbean for the most part, is also telling us about Liverpool, thinking about quaysides, thinking about the sea, thinking about people who go to sea. It's obviously crucial in like making that connection. But there's also like a really nice, and just to contradict myself a bit, there's a nice quote from a letter from James Curry, who I suppose is one of those people, like letter writing members of the middle class. But he talks about the discussion of slavery in Liverpool is reaching a kind of fever pitch. This is like in the 1780s. And he says that the struggle between interest and humanity has made great havoc in the happiness of many families. And I just thought that was such a lovely expression, between interest and humanity. Interest, like obviously being shorthand for the slave interest. Understanding in those terms, you know, interest, private interest, the will and the desire to, and the imperative to make profit, and then humanity, the interests and the requirements of the species, I think like is interesting and like a useful way of bringing like this question of like humanity, which I think is really undergirds a lot of like the these episodes and people and communication that Scott is excavating in the book. When when you say that, like, yeah, this book seems like of this time as opposed to of its own time in the 80s, I think that's true. But I do think that in some respects, it rubs against the current tendency of some literature and history. And I want to be careful here because, you know, it's not like my field. But like in some respects, you know, there's a tendency, not just in history, but among activists as well, to denigrate humanism for the understandable reason that humanism and the understanding of the human that came out of like the European tradition is like a racist understanding of the human that doesn't allow for non-European peoples and or women or, you know, or lots of like people there are lots of people excluded from that idea of the human. But, you know, what's clear is that if that was the case, you know, nobody had told the people who were like fleeing from ships, right, that they weren't humans and that was their lot in life. No one had told them that. They didn't think that. They thought that they were human beings. They thought that was the basis for their struggle for freedom. That was what legitimized that, you know, even if it didn't require legitimation because they, you know, they took it for granted that that's who they were, but they also were prepared to express it in those terms. Like, I think how, like, news about things like the French Revolution is, you know, this is perhaps like reading between the lines a little bit, maybe extrapolating too much, but like it's seen as, okay, like the French have woken up to the fact that we're all human beings. Let's explore the implications of that. Let's seize this opportunity now for ourselves. I should say that, you know, some of these ideas, I'm kind of like going off what, as like I saw a talk by Robin Kelly on YouTube where he talks about Julius Scott's book, and he talks a little bit about that, about humanity as well. So I should give credit where it's due there. But yeah, I think that also like brings up another way in which I think that Scott's interpretation of the Haitian Revolution is kind of running against or not necessarily in concert with current trends in the historiography, which, if I understand correctly, emphasize the African origins of the Haitian Revolution and of slave revolts more broadly in the Afro-American world. I'm sure there's a lot in that historiographical tendency, and like I say, it's not my field. And it makes sense in a way when you think that like the majority of people, or like I don't know if it's the majority or like half the people at any one time who were slaves on Caribbean islands were born in Africa, because it's such a brutal and murderous existence that there's a constant like need to refresh forced labor by kidnapping more people from Africa and bring them over. So it's kind of like logical that to a great extent, techniques of warfare, understandings of humanity, freedom, and politics are being imported with those people, right? That they're not coming as blank slates to the Caribbean. These are human beings who have an understanding of themselves and of their communities and things like that. They're able to like interpret their reality and struggle on the basis of that. But I do think that Scott really makes an unanswerable case that even, you know, that while we can accept that, it doesn't have to be an either or situation, right? That because people are being brought to the Caribbean with the like sorts of politics and ideas and things intact from Africa, or at least, you know, they're bringing that with them, that doesn't mean that they're not then able to respond to, interpret, and seize opportunities that are being blown in by the wind and the currents in a different, from different direction. You know, I think that's actually really important. If there's a tendency to like move away from that, then I think people should bear in mind like what's being lost there as well. You know, like the capacity of enslaved people to fight against their oppressors is we can take as a given. You know, I think we should also need to appreciate, you know, the capacity of enslaved people to interact with the fugitive ideas that are coming from Europe as well. That doesn't like lessen the achievement of the Haitian Revolution in any way, I don't think. And I have heard that said, you know, like perhaps in just casual ways in conversations rather than like argued in books, because I've heard people say that, oh, you know, the Haitian Revolution is the most radical event that's ever happened in world history. And that's because it was like a non-European thing. It was like African people relying on their own resources. And I just don't know if that's, I don't think that's the whole truth. And I think that's something that Scott like makes clear, right? That there's an encounter going on that has its own radical potential. And, you know, that doesn't make it any less of an extraordinary achievement. And it doesn't make it any less radical either, in the sense of like taking society from its roots and overturning it.
There's quite strong echoes there with some of the positions that Gilroy makes in The Black Atlantic, that this is, it's not about an either or. This is a, it's a, it's a horrific situation, but it's also a new situation, a couple of centuries old, and one which is going to generate some of its own sort of things. And to write in the impact of the French Revolution on the plantation economies of the Caribbean isn't to say that this was just dictated by France or by European ideas, that this was just one way. It's to acknowledge that that stream of ideas was there, and it was coming into contact with existing practices and with the new environment that it was in, and creating this turbulence. You know, the evidence that Scott's got there, you know, shows a clearer an understanding of the French Revolution, as you say, which goes, you know, way beyond what most French revolutionaries were thinking in Paris at the time. But nevertheless, it's using that language, using that framework in order to say, all right, well, yeah, okay, you're saying all men are equal. Well, great. So we'll make ourselves equal. It's quite clear, you know, the proclamation that comes from Paris, you know, comes a long time after the major uprising, insurrection in Haiti. It doesn't come from that legislation. Their freedom doesn't come from that sort of European one way sort of, okay, we've made you free now. But at the same time, it's using that language, and it's using that those principles in a way to turn them on their head. And it goes back to what you said about, you know, the sort of the long end of the slave trade in Britain. And, you know, yes, the kind of Wilberforce narrative is an element of it, but it's that element that's, again, really great passages again in the book of how that news filters in and how it's adapted, or how it's kind of pushed and radicalized again in Jamaica, and how that then spreads to Cuba, where the, you know, moves within the Spanish world are also tentatively heading this way. And it's not one or the other. I don't think it's helpful to think of things in terms of what's the root cause, what's the one thing that caused the Haitian Revolution to happen, because as Scott outlines really brilliantly, is that there's all these different kind of things that are coming in, you know, different people, different experiences, different backgrounds. And not only does that give us a more, I think, vibrant, you know, sense of what is going on in Saint-Domingue or Haiti at the end of the 18th century, it allows us to use that and think about other, you know, events in history and the contemporary world, rather than trying to think, well, this is that, and this belongs to that tradition and that culture and that history, and therefore that's where it belongs. And these are the people that can participate in it, and these are the people that can draw inspiration from it. And saying, no, these things are the result of constant exchange and intermingling. And I think you'd be hard pushed in a way to, you know, attempt in any sense to recreate the circumstances of the context which caused this particular episode of revolutionary history to happen. But you can look at what's going on in a broader sense and see that happening everywhere. And I think that the way that kind of revolutionary change is depicted in the book, it reminded me of how my history teacher in secondary school used to talk about the First World War, which was like a room filling full of gas. And then all it took was a match. And there was something about that I felt in this work. You know, you get three chapters really of rumor and gossip and exchanges and interactions. And you can almost feel this kind of this air filling, you know, with the potential for revolution. And it comes in Haiti. But, you know, the way that Scott's depicting it, it could have come somewhere else. It could have come in Jamaica, in Cuba, in Venezuela. There's nothing kind of fixed about it, this growing pressure. Yes, you know, the specific context will frame then exactly how that develops, and the very quick kind of response and shutdown of some of these routes of communication and so on mean that it doesn't spread. But that doesn't mean that it couldn't have, or that it couldn't have happened elsewhere.
In a way, it does spread, doesn't it? Because it spreads to France. Like we said, the abolition of slavery in the French dominions comes quite a while after the slave revolt begins in Haiti, after the, you know, the slaves have successfully fought off the French armies. There's a moment, one of the ways in which C.L.R. James's book is so like illuminating in terms of like the way he talks about revolution and boomerang effect. There's a moment, isn't there, where like the French Assembly, under pressure, like from the radical, masterless people of Paris, right, the sans-culottes, but also under pressure and like having their own ideas of liberty expanded and challenged by the slaves in Saint-Domingue, are like pressed into this like new and higher understanding of their own revolution. And there's a wonderful Danton quote about this, how up to now, everything that we've done has been selfish, has just been like a way of like improving our own situation. But now we offer the revolution to the world. And he said, England is dead today. And it's like, okay, yeah. I mean, there's an alternative history there that starts in that room and that idea, England is dead today. Unfortunately, it didn't quite turn out like that. That question of the revolution's internationalization, which is really developed in James's work. In Scott's work, it's like he talks about it more in terms of the immediate impact in the areas that are geographically closer to Haiti. Like we said, like some places are a day's canoe ride away, which is like, I mean, such an evocative idea, right? Such an interesting way of understanding geography. I'm somebody who's like, my own geographical understanding is absolutely hopeless. It's great the way the book kind of coaches you through that. And if you read it with like a map handy, I think it works really well. You get a real sense of the movement of ideas with the currents of the sea and everything else. It really shows how the echoes of Haiti, right? And this proof that after this build-up of tension that you were describing, after these like years in which ideas are being debated and result in like these revolts here and revolts there, it finally explodes and proves that Black people can overthrow the white people, you know, to put it in blunt terms, and govern themselves, which is like we were talking about last week, you know, something that's impossible in the world, right? Just like the general strike of the slaves was in America. So that idea, self-emancipation, it's always impossible till it happens. And it happened, and that like massively impacted populations as they receive that news. It results in defeated risings elsewhere, and you know has an afterlife that possibly that's not over. You know, its afterlife is maybe not over in terms of its like continuing inspiring example. But that determination not to allow the revolution of Haiti to spread throughout the Caribbean is something that really comes across in Scott's epilogue, which in a way questions the it doesn't undermine or challenge the triumph of the Haitian Revolution. But I suppose it puts into your mind, like, what's being narrated here. It's definitely not just a triumph. It's definitely not just a victory. And I think, you know, in some ways, the title of the book is, like, evocative here, because the common wind, okay, comes from this Wordsworth poem. Again, probably, you know, just thinking about the tenor of the times, like, and if the book was written today, choosing a poem by Wordsworth, who's obviously a canonical white English writer, probably, you know, is maybe something that wouldn't happen, I don't know. That poem, and obviously the common wind is, like, such an evocative idea, and it brings to mind, like, our commonality, humanity, but also like the wind as a driver of ships and ideas. But the poem is addressed to Toussaint Louverture while he's in chains in a French prison and about to die. That comes from a rescuing of hope and of possibility and a revolutionary change from the moment of defeat. So I don't think that's entirely coincidental that that's the title of the book. And the epilogue of the book talks about how when the British army withdrew from Haiti, if you don't know about, right, it's probably the most extraordinary military victory and just as importantly military defeat for the British possibly in history. You know, it is incredible, like this most powerful country in the world at that time with the most powerful like navy and everything sends this force to repress a slave uprising and is beaten, is defeated, has to withdraw in disgrace after having spent millions of pounds and lost thousands and thousands of men. The final like deal that the British say, okay, we'll leave and we won't come back, and they sign a deal with Toussaint Louverture, the great Haitian leader, that says we won't bother you anymore, we will effectively respect the autonomy of the black governed side of this island, which at the time still Saint-Domingue, but you have to promise that you won't try and export this revolution to Jamaica. And Toussaint signs that agreement. And, you know, the consequences are really bad for Haiti because it leads to effectively a kind of naval encirclement that it tries to ensure the terms of that treaty. But, you know, the common wind, this idea, the movement, the natural movement, the unstoppable movement of ideas and of hope and of an understanding of yourself as someone who deserves to be free. Again, it's like we can extract it from that, even from that moment, even knowing as we do that, you know, Haiti was like punished for centuries, is still being like punished for having dared to rise up and enact its freedom in the way that it did. In spite of the terms of that treaty, in spite of the naval blockade of Haiti that happened subsequently, these ideas were still transmitted. They were still communicated. You know, you couldn't repress that common wind ultimately. And hopefully there is a story there that will continue, that is unfinished.
Found the epilogue quite moving as well. You know, I knew in a broad sense that kind of spectre of Haiti, you know, very quickly developed. You know, as soon as it became apparent that it was going to stay an independent territory, you know, which had abolished slavery, I knew then that it, you know, from that point it had been contained, you know, as much as possible. This economic and transportation, like hobbling of Haiti, the British and the US working together to ensure that this independent black nation, you know, cannot physically export these ideas. It cannot go. And yet, as you say, and yet there is this wind, this commonality, you know, still reaching out. You know, Scott mentions how these exchanges continue on, how they provide sort of refuge for Simon Bolivar during the sort of Venezuelan revolution, which goes on to kind of lead to the independence of most of South America. You see it in the largest slave revolt in North American history in New Orleans in 1811. Again, you know, this is an area that I didn't imagine New Orleans in the world of Jamaica and Haiti, but it very much is one node in that interlinking web of places. And, you know, that this was a French colony, then a Spanish colony, and then brought into the American orbit. And, you know, there's these people passing through constantly, and Haiti remains, you know, something of a watchword for slaves, basically across all of these societies, which perpetuate this, you know, horrific system. And it remains this example of what can be achieved. And while the Royal Navy's, you know, efforts are successful in some ways in containing, you know, in a very direct sense, what's going on in Haiti, it cannot, as you say, be totally sort of sealed off from the world.
I suppose it's just interesting, isn't it, that's the resource that the counter-revolution offers, right? First, it tries to defeat you militarily, and then it tries to just seal you off from the rest of the world. And I think that's just played out again and again subsequently. And I suppose it just like sort of brings home how like the need of governments and nation states to control movement is, you know, in and of itself is a counter-revolutionary maneuver. This is where it comes from. You know, you have the United States, this young, newly independent nation, debating migration policy straight away in the wake of the Haitian Revolution. And that's, you know, what it's about. We have this idea of the United States as accepting the huddled masses of persecuted Europe. And, you know, of course, it's not like there aren't stories that reflect that narrative. I mean, we were talking in the last episode about refugees from 1848 in Germany fighting and the slave revolt during the American Civil War. But this feeling of an imperative need among like people like Thomas Jefferson to stop black people coming from Haiti with the news, with the truth, with the proof of the possibility of self-emancipation. Is like that's an imperative from the get-go for this new nation. And of course, America has lots of like specific aspects to its history, but that is not specific to it. You know, that desire, that need to try and control the movement of people is common to all of these nation states. And it has that, but it has this common root to prevent the spread of subversion effectively. I mean, this is like, I suppose when I think about the book in terms of like defeat, and not just as a temporary defeat in the sense of the blockade of Haiti, because, you know, like we say, that isn't a defeat ultimately. You know, Haiti's achievement and the extraordinary like story of emancipation, self-emancipation, that is, you know, stands forever. But there's like a broader world historical defeat for the masterless people who populate Scott's book, that were then forced into these national blocks, forced into, you know, a working class that is effectively integrated into the capitalist social condition, you know, the economy, and which then, you know, fights appalling global wars against one another. I suppose like that's why, like when reading the book, like sometimes you feel like this is a message from the future, because it kind of demonstrates a level of intercommunication and common purpose that, I'm not saying it's impossible or anything like that. I'm not saying that, you know, that it won't happen again. Or, you know, obviously it needs to, but it doesn't seem like it's easy to even to conceptualize at the moment. Like you say, people talk about the internet. Well, people talk about canoes. People talk about canoe, right? How you could get from one island to another in a day on a canoe, regardless of like the quality of the technology, or, you know, what an advance it represents in terms of our ability to communicate with one another. If we are not seeing the people on the other side of that communication, if there isn't that like commonality, right? If we're not breathing in the same common air, exhaling the same common wind, then frankly, it doesn't really matter like how easy it is to communicate with one another.
Perhaps, you know, I would go back to the metaphor of my teacher there. I mean, perhaps things do look, you know, less feasible, I suppose, at the moment, to kind of recreate something of this world of exchanges and shared purpose. Maybe we're in it's going to sound terrible. Maybe we're in the point at which things feel full of gas. You know, there hasn't been that moment, that inspirational moment, that puncturing of the status quo that inspires something as world changing as the Haitian Revolution. And we would look back, you know, someone writing the book of, you know, the great revolution of the 21st century would look to this period much as you would of the early 18th century, of one of demonstrable networks and communications and shared ideas, but without, you know, perhaps the real impetus or opportunity to actually affect that change right there and then.
And obviously there are like grounds for hope, and like the way that things like Black Lives Matter protest like exceeded the bounds of the states over the summer and like became like this worldwide phenomenon was extremely exciting and encouraging and an indication of how quickly things might and can change. But I suppose, like, you know, the great advantage when we like read it, like historically, when we think about these like masterless people, was that they weren't confined by national structures in quite the same way. I don't mean to end on a downer, and we should stay with your positive idea that, you know, well, things might look bleak, but look on the bright side, we might be in a room filling up with gas.
Well, we kind of are. You know, we're in a world that's filling full of carbon dioxide gas, and, you know, something's going to explode.
Thanks for listening. As ever, you can follow the podcast on Twitter and Facebook, both at ABC Danny and Jim, and get in touch via our email, abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com. The podcast music is Stealing Orchestra, Gente de Miniaterra. The podcast logo is an adapted version of the Left Book Club logo. And the image in this episode is a photograph of the statue Les Marins Inconnus in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, which is available in the public domain. More information on all of these materials can be found in the show notes. Love and solidarity. Until next time. Thank you.
filmes. Senhor Secretário de Estado, faz favor de... Tenha a palavra.
Senhora Presidente,